Good morning. My name is Nat Francis. I'm a managing director at Weaver, and I work in the Forensics and Litigation Services Group. And I'm here this morning with Morgan Page, who's a partner and leads the digital transformation and automation practice here at Weaver. And as someone who's operated in the investigations and forensic space for about a decade and a half, it's still interesting to learn about what's new and what's possible in the digital forensic space. So I wanted to speak with you, Morgan, as our resident expert in this field, and learn a bit more. So thanks for being here with me today and taking the time to chat about this.
Absolutely. Glad to be here.
So related to litigation and discovery, what have you been seeing recently in terms of how people like you with a strong digital forensics background are providing value in terms of gathering information and advising lawyers on what to look for and how to look for it?
Sure. So we're seeing a ton of new things. And one of the things I love to compare this to is we're in really the Dillinger days of what was the physical. This is what's happening in digital. So fraud has gone digital. And in the Dillinger days, he was breaking into police stations and stealing their very own weapons and their assets and using them against them. And they couldn't catch him because they didn't have enough spread and enough investigative procedures structured correctly to be able to find him, until Hoover brought the FBI in. And then there's this whole nother assessment process. There's this whole nother methodology of approach. That's where we're living in the digital forensics space right now. And when we're going into these investigations, there is a whole ecosystem of activities that are not visible to the layman. And so when attorneys are getting these investigative opportunities, if it was a physical strong arm robbery, they would immediately know, go pull cameras, go, you know, talk to witnesses. We've got that standardized playbook. But in the digital side, we don't have that. And so we're really looking at these new areas of IP addresses, authenticator interactions, code-based review, to really identify those opportunities to investigate and really catch that fraud.
So it sounds like fraud is really changing, and the way we detect it and stop it is changing as well. So can you give an example or two of litigations or investigations where you've worked with litigation counsel?
Absolutely. So one of my favorite ones pretty recently, it was a huge Ponzi scheme around Bitcoin. Basically, you buy Bitcoin from me. I know how to manage the different Bitcoin markets, this, that, and the other. You get distributions, all of that fun and excitement. And so through part of that process, figuring out who actually was doing it and who all was involved and who was getting money out, right? Because the key piece of the Ponzi scheme is you got to have a few of those I got paid people to be able to build and grow it. And so being able to pursue not just that initial fraudster, but that initial tranche of investors, if you will. And so the difficulty is this was not a U.S.-based issue. And so being able to get that information, being able to work through identifying where those people were geographically, work through those regional authorities and the regional technology litigative restrictions to be able to identify this is actually Jim Bob or Sally Sue or the key person that we're trying to target. So how we kind of went about that was, to me, a ton of fun. But hey, I'm a nerd. So what we did was we actually took the code base of the application and did an in-depth review of the programming. And one of the really fun things we found there is the original programmer, because the person running a website is usually not who actually created it. And so that original programmer was actually, when they were testing, they didn't go back and clean up their code. And so the original testing password and username was available. And so we were able to go into that comment section, pull that out, and then use that to get to the next step in the investigation and go, okay, now we can get into this place that we all thought was locked. The fraudster's nowhere to be found. He won't give us the password, but we found another way around, right? So the physical equivalent of the fraudster won't open the door, but you talk to the girlfriend and she opens the door for you, right? And so we were able to get to that next step. And then from there, we were able to start pulling from authenticator information, actual GPS coordinates. And so the really great thing about this is one of the fraudsters was very, very sharp. And so he used Proton VPN, which if any of y'all have ran across that, it's very difficult to pursue once you see Proton. But he also used his phone, and that was not secured at the same level. And so we were able to nail GPS coordinates of him accessing the website while on a golf course. Because, of course, he's talking about his wonderful investment decision with all of his golfing buddies.
You can catch fraudsters when they slip up and they make errors and they get a bit sloppy, especially on the digital side of things. So what about when data is hidden or seemingly erased? How have lawyers and their clients gone about finding such information with your help?
Sure. So I love to say someone somewhere left a digital fingerprint and I will find it. And some of that goes back into understanding both how the hardware and software works and interoperates. And so the first thing I'll kind of mention is around hardware. So many of you, your laptops, you've got that nice, really thin laptop. It's super fast, boots right off the bat. So the way that does that, and there's probably a little sticker in the lower right corner of your laptop that says SSD. And what that means is a solid state drive. And so that's a flash drive, if you remember the old USB keys. So the way those work is they actually have a defined life. So the old school one used magnets. You could use them forever, no big deal. But these can only be turned 0 to 1 so many times. And so from a hardware management perspective, it actually does not write over the same line as the same line. It writes all the way to the bottom of the file and goes back to the top and starts rewriting. And so what that means is even if somebody deleted it, until they've gone back through a whole terabyte of data, it's still secretly on there. The only thing the delete function actually does is deletes the street sign that tells the computer where that lives. Now, being able to pull that and identify it, I'm not saying is an easy process, but it does live and it exists there. The other way is talking about the enterprise storage medium layers. So if we're talking about not less of a person, more of a enterprise organization, that's really looking at how are they storing information and where, because most of it's not kept just on a local. And to use an example many of y'all probably encounter, you have your local device, your laptop, and you say you're in the Microsoft ecosystem using O365. That document, even if you delete it off your local drive, is still sitting in OneDrive, and it's just moved to a potential delete folder. It stays there for, by standard, at least 90 days. But oftentimes what happens is an organization has a backup and monitoring procedure as well. And so they take snapshots, and they'll store those for up to 2 years. And sometimes, depending on the organization, it might be 10 or 20, especially if you're dealing with anything in real estate or real property. And so being able to look at that structure of the environment and those governance policies to go, sure, they deleted it off the computer. Sure, they deleted it off their OneDrive. But when we remount that backup from 6 months ago, we've got our file back.
Even if data is seemingly erased or deleted, if you have the right tools and you have the right experts, it can be restored.
Gone, but not forgotten.
Yeah. So as a digital transformation expert, I assume you've worked with clients in a legal sense to evaluate the veracity of potential claims after interpreting digital data. Can you give us an example?
Sure. So probably the most obvious one that we have is today's digital workforce, right? We went through COVID, all of us learned how to work virtually, but we're seeing a lot of labor theft currently, and a lot of litigation around companies going, we have whole groups of people that have said they're working for 6 months, they're working another job, they're working, they're just not working, right? They're operating off their phone or they're have a device. There's a actually a mouse called, I think it's called the Wiggler or something like that, that is actually designed to, if you leave it just sitting on your desk, it just sits there and wiggles every once in a while. So that way your Teams always shows that you're active and available while you're off doing something else. But that is all programmatically identifiable, right? Because you go through looking at activity and monitoring, what's the keyboard operations, what's the click operations, what's endpoint management, how, what's your processing in that endpoint, and being able to see, is this really valid? Was this person working? Or is there a high potential for that to have been fraudulent? And then you're able to, based on that analysis, target your harder in-person analyses of, let me walk around near where this person is often seen, right? So if we know they're always away from their computer from the hours of 3 to 5, and they like to go to Joe Bob's restaurant, and then that's how you can investigate. Now, I'm only going to investigate Joe Bob's at 3 to 5 rather than having a PI follow them all day or something like that.
Thanks so much, Morgan. This is really, really fascinating and informative, and really appreciate you taking the time to discuss some digital forensics and how it dovetails with investigative services and litigation support. Thanks very much.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Take care.